Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, product owners all over this great big world, including the people listening in Arkansas. Oh, sorry, it's Arkansas. Welcome back to Deliver. This is your Agile Product Owners Podcast. My name is Corey Bryan, and I can see. I've acquired new glasses. One thing I've noticed is my eyesight has gone downhill over the last year from working at home, maybe? I don't know. When you stare at a screen 12 to 14 hours a day, it's going to affect your eyesight. So that's the price, is new glasses. But thankfully, I have them, and thankfully, they work. So I can see all the things, which is really good. I got a lot of good feedback from the last episode on perfection with Jeff, and it's what normally happens. There's a couple of things that I either didn't get to, didn't see, or have come up since then that I wanted to share it related to that. The first one is an article from the Scrum Alliance called In Search of the Perfect Product Owner. In this article, they list five key attributes that you need to be the perfect product owner. And I really like the story that they tell about how these five attributes lined up with the story that they have. So the first attribute for a perfect product owner is bandwidth. They are available to do the job. Something we hear a lot is product owners aren't available, or they're not as available as they should be, so you deal with a proxy. So again, they have the bandwidth to do the job. Another attribute is they have the power. In this, they have the ability, the authority to do the job, the authority to make the decisions. Again, proxies are a bad thing. They can make a decision. They can talk to who they need to talk to. They don't have to wait on things like that. They also have knowledge. The third thing is knowledge. They have a deep understanding of the market. They have a deep understanding of the product, deep understanding of the customers and what they're trying to do. They have interest. Amazing that that needs to be said, but yes, they want to do this job, this role, this effort. They're interested in doing it. It's not forced upon them. They don't regret doing it. They don't see it as something else they have to do. They are interested in doing it. And then the fifth attribute is the vision. They know what goal the product is trying to solve. They know how it relates to the business. They know how it relates to the users, and it helps them solve the problem. So I really like the way that this article, this story was told about the five things you need to do in order to be the perfect product owner. Again, not that there is such a thing, but those things are really, really good. And then I saw an article from somebody I used to work with, Alyssa Knoll, who posted on LinkedIn, The Power of Good Enough. She says that one of her side activities that she's working on, they renamed, with a group of friends, they renamed the last column of their board Good Enough. They did it kind of as a joke, mostly as a joke, but it kind of stuck. And the interesting thing about calling that last column Good Enough is that the story could be done even if it isn't perfect. That it's good enough. They know the products, they know the user's context, and could it be better? Sure. Is it finished? Probably not. Is it done to whatever we define it as? But it's not going to be perfect. So in that case, good enough. I like that. Alyssa's got some really good blog posts that she's doing, and she's doing some writing over at her blog on Product Nerds, which is a great title, something we've said before, and it's something that I very much look forward to what else she's going to be writing in the future. So check out those two articles. Also, I was reading Kent Beck's XP Explained, which is a book that I cannot believe I had not read yet, and I'm going to talk about that more in the main section, but he had a really good quote in there that I thought was applicable to this topic of perfection, and in it he says, in software development, perfect is a verb, not an adjective. There is no perfect process. There is no perfect design. There are no perfect stories. You can, however, perfect your process, your design, and your stories. So think about that when you refer to something as perfect. It's a verb and not an adjective.
No doubt that this magnificent vessel will give excellent value for the dollars she'll be earning.
I made mention of learning to see waste an episode or two ago as I was reading Paul Icker's books. I read another one recently, To Second Lean, And there's a great amount of info he gives about waste and why Lean abhors it. There's also been many other instances of waste popping in my vision of late, and I wanted to talk about the different types of waste in our product lives, including product, process, and our thinking. The other major recent influence for this was that I finally sat down and read through XP Explained from Kent Beck. It's a great book on the foundations of what all teams, Scrum or not, should be doing from an engineering standpoint. I've gotten to the point where I see waste everywhere. At work, at home, my desk, wherever I'm at, I see it, and it makes me crazy sometimes. When I'm driving somewhere, when I'm getting a meal, when I'm figuring out my day, a sad and simple truth is there is so much waste that we deal with. In fact, Paul mentions in his book that 90% is waste. You and I are extremely productive at producing non-value-added activity, he says. Think about that. 90% of what you do, it certainly feels right most of the time. I couldn't find a study or info that backs it up, though. I imagine whatever real number is, generally, it's roughly right. Kent mentions that there is so much waste in software development. The waste is rooted more in what we believe and feel than what we do. So, many of the activities, processes, best practices, and even careers are so heavily invested in those things that got us to where we are. We believe in them so much, this new thing can't possibly work. If it did, that's a threat to me. So the waste continues. The mediocrity, in the best cases, continues. Paul's book helped me understand something that I've been struggling with for the last few years also. I see the wastes and others don't. I try to point it out. I try to work around it, change things so the waste goes away. And I haven't taught the others to see it with me. I just make a change or argument, and most of the times, that doesn't work out as well as it could. So that's job one then, getting people to see the waste for themselves. If you can't see the eight waste in everything you do, then it's very difficult to eliminate the waste. Waste from building the wrong product at the wrong time in the wrong order for the wrong person. Once people can see it, then you can work on eliminating it with them. That's the essence of Lean. So what are the eight wastes, and where do they make themselves known? Where do they show up, hide in the dark sometimes, and unknowingly drag us down into the abyss? The first waste is overproduction. It all starts with making too much of a thing. Taichi Ono, the spiritual leader of TPS, says the greatest waste is the waste of overproduction. If you make something and can't sell it, the effort that went into making that is lost. All the other wastes on this list originate and start with this one, making too many things. Think of all the features, the projects, the stories, all the things that we're asked to do, all the things the teams that we are on are doing, the thousand different directions that we find ourselves in. We are overproducing. The second waste is transport. Those things we made and made too much of, we have to move them somewhere. This is easy to see in the physical world. I made a bunch of food and I have to make space for something else. We have to move our sticky notes and laptops from meeting to meeting. We have multiple teams that require handoffs before something can get deployed. That code needs to move from place A to place Q. Third is excess inventory. All the things that we created too many of, now we have to store them somewhere. Inventory is not hard at all to see in software development. It's anything that we haven't released to the customer yet. All the work in your backlog, all the work in progress, all the work that's done and just waiting for some other group to do something else. All of that is inventory. I've longed to be able to manifest something to make every story or epic that's in our park backlogs and any unreleased work appear real. My favorite one is start putting dumpsters in parking lots, making people work around them. Something real, something not hidden, an electronic tool that is easily ignored or avoided. In lean circles, you can see the inventory. You can see it stacking up and being in the way. We have so many things that are sitting, waiting for something to happen. So much money that we could be earning. So much value we could be delivering. Sitting there waiting for something to happen while we wait for something else to happen. Fourth is defects. Something's wrong. We made a mistake. The customer didn't want pickles. The returns process can't be completed. There was a security breach for the U.S. accounts. These have a double whammy with the next one. Mistakes cost money, reputation, and time. There are things we could do to significantly reduce the occurrence of defects, or at the minimum, catch them when they occur and fix them immediately. test automation, pairing, CI/CD, more frequent checking. Imagine getting to a place where you only have one bug a month or two a year. It's possible if you're paying attention to them. Because we have defects, we have to correct them. Well, I suppose we could let them go if the downside isn't too bad, or if it's only that customer. But if we do need to fix it, it's the fifth waste, overprocessing. We have to go back to the thing we already worked on and correct it. We have to open back up that code, pull that story back up, and see what happened. If that story was done 10 minutes ago, it's not that big of a deal. If that story was done 3 months ago and was sitting, waiting for someone to test, or release, or use it, that's a bigger deal. What was the thing supposed to do again? We've forgotten because we're on to the next things. We waste more time redoing and redoing a thing that we left to focus on. Waste number six is wasting motion. More handoffs, this time from closer to completion to further up the line, to the left of the board. How many different boards do you have to switch between views for the team that you work with? How many different ways do you have to show and talk to stakeholders and customers about the work, the goals, the ideas that your product will solve? How many times do you flip back and forth between them? Hell, how many tabs do you have open in your browser right now? I have way too many. Upwards of 80, I'd bet. I lose a lot of time switching tabs. What happens while all the waste listed above are going on? That's right. It's waste number seven, waiting. The customer, the person who value is supposed to be given, is waiting. They wait for the story to be done. They wait for the story to be delivered. Wait for it to be released. They wait until they can touch it, make use of it. We are waiting for feedback from them. We wait for sign-offs. We wait for approvals. We wait for everything. One of the most frustrating things is watching them make my burrito at my local fast food restaurant and seeing the orders in front of it. Mine isn't being touched. Hell, the other three in front of mine aren't being touched. We are all waiting. Customers don't like to wait, especially if they can see what the problems are. I start getting really bent out of shape when I can't see things happening. No progress on a story, no responses from a question, nobody putting cheese on my food. Why is there waiting? It's something in those other six wastes that I mentioned. Maybe the last waste to look and see is the wasted potential that we cost ourselves from the people on the team. The people doing the work couldn't improve what we were doing, the way we were doing it, or the value being delivered because we were making too many things that had too many problems that nobody cared about. Instead of getting better at pushing code to production, we were handling another sales request that didn't matter. Instead of experimenting on how to make the report cleaner, we resolved another 100 defects. Paul had a devastating quote in his book about a longtime engineer upon his retirement. When reflecting at his going away party, he said, "For 30 years, they had the work of my hands. They could have had the work of my head and my heart for no extra cost, but they never asked." Think about that. They never once asked in 30 years if this guy had an idea on how to make his work better, how to improve what he was doing, the value the customer could get from it. How depressing is that? How often do we ask our teams how to improve? How much space do we give them to do that? How hard do we fight to give it to them? This waste is the one that Paul mentions as the greatest offender. The unused employee potential. How much better could we be if we asked more of our people? If we listened to them more? If we let them help us deliver more value? There is a nomination for a ninth waste, and that is of politics. It's egos that get in the way of fixing most of the other wastes. I agree with that, and I don't know which of the others it impacts the most. The arrogance and overproduction, the ignorance of waiting, the deceit and defects. One thing for sure, if you look for the ego, the waste of politics is usually right next to it. So that's the list, the wastes that are everywhere. We make too much that we have to move, store, find the defects, fix the defects, move it over again, the customer waits, and we can't improve what we're doing. As a product owner, I have spent so much time organizing my waste, my backlogs with their boards and components and dashboards. Oh, Lord, the dashboards. Work that doesn't remove a limitation is waste, as Kent says. Those improvement items that come out of a retro or building in time to change, that's where that happens. These wastes, once you know of them, are so easy to find. Paul says that finding the waste component is not a burden. It's a game. It's a scavenger hunt. It's why I often talk about maps and big visual displays to show myself and others where these wastes are. Once you know what the wastes are and help others to see them, that's when you can really start to make progress. Anything that doesn't add value, and obvious value, is waste. We should try to eliminate as much of that as possible, as soon as possible. If you can't eliminate a step, can you reduce the time that step takes? If it takes a team 3 days to wait for approval for something, how can that be cut to 1 day, to a half day, to an hour, to not needing to wait for approval at all? Another common ask is, if our customers knew we were doing this, if this was happening, would they pay for it? Are we charging the customer ultimately for our own ignorance? Kent says very clearly that, quote, customers pay for what the system does today and what the team can make the system do tomorrow. Any artifacts contributing to those two sources of value are themselves valuable. Everything else is waste, end quote. That leads to an obvious question then. What are the things that are going on that are necessary and unnecessary waste? Is planning necessary waste? Some of it is, I think. How about the backlog? Again, to a certain size, I'd still stick with that Dunbar number of 150 as a maximum, and I could argue for much less as necessary waste of inventory. Is testing a waste? Depends on where it happens. If it's a different group and a different sprint, then I think yes. If it's a pair working with you as the team creates, then no, I don't think that's waste. Creating stories is not waste, I think. Creating stories for things you don't need now could be a waste, especially if the customer doesn't need it now or can't make use of it now. How about some of the experiments and ideas we are testing out? What if something fails? Is that waste? Kent says if it imparts knowledge, then no. Knowledge is valuable and sometimes hard to come by. Look into the products and where we are wasting our customers' time, energy, and effort. What are the friction points they encounter and what are they wasting there? Your product could have way too many screens or menus that are a form of overproduction, too much stuff. What could you simplify or remove to make better? How many different screens do customers have to navigate between to get what they want, to do what they need to do? Map out their journey, not only in your app, but in their experience working with your product. What defects are they finding and finding often? What does that stop them from doing? How much time with support are they spending? How could that be reduced? The back and forth of screens, emails, requests, feedback. Most of that could be waste and eliminated to make everything and everybody better. How much time do they wait for things to happen in the app? To log in or run something, to see data, information, pull up a record. How long does the entire process take to complete their task or their job? What things are we limited in their ability to do? How much more productive, successful, or impactful could our customers be if our product was better? Why aren't we helping them do more? What could we help them do more of? These are all the questions and ideas around waste in our product, in our team, in our process, and ourselves. The only one that you can really focus on is yours. Where do you have waste in how you're working? Start with that. Get rid of or reduce something within the next 24 hours. Something that you're doing, don't start using Jira to think about an epic. Don't have a meeting to update a stakeholder. Don't stuff a sprint with things that don't matter right now. If you're successful and if others ask, help them. Paul says that's a sign of a mature, lean culture, when they are comfortable enough to be able to ask you where you see their waste. If you need or want to go, do, or move faster, this is how you do it, by eliminating the waste, not whipping the ponies harder. Imagine if you could reduce the time to get something out the door by 50%, the time it takes to deliver value to the customer from 6 months to 1 month, the build time from 2 days to 2 hours, the amount of defects that are created from 200 a month to 5, from 6 handoffs to 0, from 2,000 items in a backlog to 50. Everything can be improved. And as Agile and Lean and Scrum teams, that's part of what you're signing up for, continuous improvement. That means making things better, sure. It also means making things suck less. What really bugs you, the team, the customer? Fix it. I'll end with this section from Kent. Software development is full of the waste of overproduction. Fat requirements documents that rapidly grow obsolete. Elaborate architectures that are never used. Code that goes months without being integrated, tested, and executed in a production environment. And documentation no one reads until it's irrelevant or misleading. While all of these activities are important to software development, we need to use their output immediately in order to get the feedback we need to eliminate waste. If you eliminate enough waste, soon you will go faster than the people who are just trying to go fast. If you have any feedback or questions about a product ownership, you can contact the show on Twitter at Delivercast or email at delivercast@gmail.com. Please share the show around with friends or coworkers, subscribe, and help us reach more folks. And yes, I realize that I have not read Lean Software Development by the Poppendykes, which I need to do. So I'm going to read that next month, I think. So a couple questions. One is from Product Pen, says, "Hey, Corey, is an avid follower of your podcast. I'm wondering if you have an opinion on how to formulate user stories, dealing with an article on the possible consequences with writing as a I want so that. Believe the product teams, UX, UI, and devs will consider each proposal differently, perhaps even consider some of them as a sign of arrogancy from the PO. How do you see it?" All right, so if the PO did it themselves, I can see that happening. I really think this is more around the collaboration effort and how much collaboration effort you put in it. If the PO is working with the designers and engineers on personas and problems and goals, then I think it would be less of an issue. So maybe if 30% of the stories that you're writing was just you doing it, and then maybe another 70% was done together or changed together, then I think that would be something better. I think they would be seen as less arrogant. And again, we did episode 86 on other story types, which I think if you want to get out of that zombie format of user stories, I like the format, but it can be a crutch. There are some other types you can do. So encourage everybody to check that out. Then I got a question from Rob. It says, "Hey, Corey, can you recommend any conferences or meetups for PO that are highly valuable? I continue to enjoy the podcast and been recommending it to the POs I'm coaching here at work. Thanks in advance." Good conferences, good meetups for POs. The big ones, Mind the Product, All Their Things. Industry is a big conference. Front, I think, is a pretty big conference. The Product Tanks, there's lots of good little meetups that you can find. Product in the Aether is something I've been wanting to join for a while. There's lots of little ones that I've been meaning to get on. And for the last while, we could join from anywhere. It's been good on those. So I like those, Mind the Product Industry Front. Haven't been doing a lot of meetups lately. Been finding more value in books, actually. But I still do the Moose Herd. I still do a few other things like that. And the last question is from Daryl, who has a question about handling multiple customers that want the same feature. Says, "If I have two customers that would both like the same feature, would you typically have a user story for each customer or identify both customers in one user story?" I would identify the same problem in the same story for the same persona. And that's what I would write the story as, that's what I would build it as, and that's what I'd probably release it as. I would not target a specific customer. I would say, for people who have this type of problem, this is the thing that we've built that will solve that for you and get their feedback. So be very hard-pressed to build one feature for one customer, or call this the client A feature. That seems bad. That's not product-focused. That's very project-focused or contract-focused type work. So I would stay away from that as much as possible, Daryl. So I hope that helps. Don't forget that if you would like any one-to-one coaching, product consulting, or organizational agility help, I do offer that consulting over at seektaiju.com. All opinions expressed here are mine. Find more of them at @IsCoreyBryant on Twitter. That is episode 131 delivered. Go out and own the outcome.
Podcast Network. For more shows and information, visit agilepodcastnetwork.com.